afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are watching from. This is Hashtag No Limits, and I am your host, Shelley Kino. On Hashtag No Limits, I interview people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I'm sorry that I am distracted, but I had to run my episode on my other screen just to make sure it was running because I've heard that there's been some Facebook issues. So I've now turned that off. So Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves back into cells and then reforms into the butterfly. As if that isn't difficult enough, it then needs to struggle in order for its wings to gain the strength to be able to fly when it gets out of the cocoon. I can't imagine that any of that is easy, but neither is busting through the limits that society places upon a person. Today, I'm very excited to bring from the other side of the world, literally, my guest, Dr. Shoshana Levin-Fox. She and I met through the RV. For those of you who follow me, you may have known that I was on the RV, the Relatable Voice podcast. And then they did an episode for their book fair where Dr. Fox and I were, they paired us together. And it was a beautiful pairing. Absolutely wonderful. If you haven't had a chance to watch our episode, please go over and do that. We connected so much that we absolutely said, we have to do more together because this was so much fun. So Dr. Fox, thank you for joining me. How are you today?
Hi, thank you, Shelley. Great. Yep. It's nice to see you.
Yeah. And so as I said, it was good afternoon for me, but it's good evening for you. Where are you joining me from?
I'm in Jerusalem, Israel. And when we finish this broadcast, it's going to be my bedtime, Shelley.
Yeah. I think you're about 8 hours ahead of me time-wise.
Right.
So, yeah. And so I appreciate you doing this so late in the evening.
No, it's not that. No. It's fine. The night is young.
Okay. And we already have someone who's joined us. And I do forget to say this sometimes. If you are joining us live, please let us know with the hashtag live. If you watch this in the replay, let us know that as well. And let us know where you're from, especially because in this particular one, we are on two different parts, two different continents, two different parts of the world. Fran happens to be joining from Southern Illinois. So I appreciate that. So Dr. Fox, what is it that you and I connected so much about?
Well, I was just listening to you now talk about the butterfly metaphor, Shelley. And I think what surprised us really was from my corner in the field of autism as a psychologist and from your corner as an educator, we were both profoundly committed to helping children realize their potential beyond the labels, beyond what anyone else was thinking about that child, seeing that potential and bringing it to realization. So,
yeah,
I think that for me, that was really the, and I think for you too, you know, it was a surprise. We had so much in common from different fields of specialization. So, yeah.
Right. And being on the Relatable Voice podcast or on that book fair episode, the main reason that we were both on there is because we're both authors. I just have one book out, but you have, I think, a few. Just one?
I have just one book. I've done book chapters. I've done articles. I'm still writing articles and so on. You want to see the baby? Here's the baby.
Yes, absolutely. Share that.
Sure.
Yes.
An autism casebook for parents and practitioners, the child behind the symptoms. It's basically my legacy to the field because I just wanted to take what I had learned in 25 years of working at a very special place. I'll tell you more about that later. With a very special perspective, I wanted to get that out and just share it with as many people that I could because we were seeing children change. And the reason was, Shelley, we're working out of the box. You know, you're talking about no limits, just no, in so many directions that we were just putting aside the conventional view in many respects. So I can tell you more about that later in particulars, but it's a legacy, and most of it's stories of the children, because I really wanted the progress of the children to show parents and practitioners what is possible.
Yeah.
That was so important.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, I haven't read your book, but how can people find your book if they want to get it and read it?
Easy peasy. Amazon, Goodreads, and if they forget how to spell my name, and Shoshana Levin Fox, and it's got all these different parts, they just type in an autism casebook. It has a longer title. Just type in an autism casebook into Amazon, and it's on the Routledge side as Barnes & Noble, Goodreads, all those.
Awesome. And I have your website here on the screen now. Is it possible to purchase your book through your website?
Yeah, well, I think we put a hyperlink on it that takes people to Amazon, so it's the same thing. Yeah,
that's fine. Yeah, I know for me, people can buy it through me, and then I autograph it, or they can buy it like all the places that you said. So, so if you are looking to find her, Dr. Shoshana Levin Fox, it's www.shoshanalevinfox.com. And while I'm talking about it, I'm just going to pull up the website just so they know that they've gotten to the right place. If that's the if they're interested in you a little bit more than what we're going to learn about you today. Sure. So right here, I just love this little face. That's just.
Oh, I saw that face on Getty Images when I was asked to pick a cover for the book. And I said, that's it. That little guy. You know, obviously he's not one of the children I worked with. Right. That's pretty clear. But can't do that. But,
perfect. So tell us more about the book. I know in our discussion with Lucia that you worked with a lot of kids that came to you because they had an autism diagnosis, but you found that not to be true.
Completely. Maybe that's the place that I should start, actually, Shelley. You know, I guess, as you know, I'm a child psychologist and trained in play therapy and so on. Had a career-long interest in autism. And then in 1992, I received a SHRC, which is Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, postdoc, that for research in autism. That's the proposal I put in. So I'm just sort of starting giving a little bit of background about how I got to the conclusion that so many children were being misdiagnosed. And I had the good fortune, I actually chose it, but I didn't know what a wonderful place it was going to turn out to be. And that was to ask to do my research project at the Feuerstein Institute in Jerusalem. Okay, I'm going to spell that for your readers because it sounds like foyer, F-O-Y-E-R, but it's, get this, it's F-E-U-E-R, Steen Institute in Jerusalem. And the Professor Feuerstein, who died in 2014 at a very advanced age, was a brilliant, iconoclastic, courageous psychologist. All psychology, and I'm speaking as a trained psychologist with a doctorate in the field, psychology is loaded with jargon. Mm-hmm. It's loaded with jargon. And some of that jargon can be extremely helpful and insightful. And some of it can just be kind of noise that takes us away from really understanding who we're working with. So the context was that this professor, for many years, from after the Second World War, had developed a whole perspective on actualizing learners' potential that had nothing to do with IQs, nothing to do with norms. His famous saying, this will give you a flavor of the man and of the Institute, which was an incredible place where I worked at for 25 years. He said, I will never give the chromosome the last word. Okay?
Oh, okay.
That sort of says it. He says, yeah, oh, the chromosomes do what they do. Okay. Hair brown, hair blonde, right. Eyes, whatever, coordination. But that's not the last word, because that can all, everything we've been given can be developed. So with that kind of mindset, I'm working at the Institute, and I started off doing the research project, but after 2 months, he called me into his office and was very extraordinarily charismatic and powerful figure. He says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, you know, I'm here to do a research project," which isn't really my favorite thing in the world to do. I'd much rather work with the kids. And he said, "I want you, your specialty is autism. I want you to work with the children." "Sure, Professor, I'm happy to do that." So he had already established all kinds of assessment measures that had nothing to do with the stuff you were learning in graduate school. He had developed interactive measures that then test what the child learns. Okay, except my specialty was autism. What are you going to do with an autistic child that doesn't know what a pencil is for?
Right.
Right, that doesn't have the task orientation, doesn't have the focus. So what you're going to do? Okay, so the principle was interact with the child and discover their learning potential. I had a background in play therapy. Interact with the child through play, the child with the autism diagnosis, and see who's really in there and what they really can do. Because play is a tremendous developmental window. It's unbelievable. So back to your question, you asked me, if I'm not mistaken, way back when, you know, why or how I came to the conclusion that so many children were being misdiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there I am at the Feuerstein Institute in Jerusalem in my little office. And I'm all these kids, I mean, I probably saw thousands of children in my career, and I'm looking at the referral information from the parent, and I'm seeing child after child after child that's been labeled autistic using the DSM. During my career, it was either the 4 or the most recent, the 5,
mm-hmm.
Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and listing all the reasons from here. This clause and this clause and this clause and this clause, this child is autistic. It wasn't long, Shelley, before I realized, whenever I read that, I'd read that and kind of smile and say, "We'll see." I want to see who this child is. Mm-hmm. I want to see what they can do. I want to see how play can reach them. I want to see how they can be brought to better communication. And a huge percentage of them were, I felt, after I saw them, had been misdiagnosed. So your question is why? I want to jump into that one. Oh boy, this is a topic close to my heart. The DSM-4 had its problems, and I had hoped that the DSM-5 would be an improvement. Want to give people an understanding. I did not use the DSM-5 throughout my, or 4 or 5 throughout my career, because I just found them not specific enough. But again, and you have to stop me if I start to go on too much, because this stuff is so close to my heart, and I saw so many children that were hurt by a misdiagnosis of autism, and so many parents that were devastated. And it turned out not to be true. So how did it happen? So I'll tell you a story. A long time ago, in the 1940s, Dr. Leo Kanner, child psychiatrist, if I'm not mistaken, identified 2 criteria for autism. Those criteria were very intense and very narrow, very tight. Extreme emotional cutoffness, extreme. Not shy, not troubles with social communication, extreme emotional cut-offness, and he used that term. And the other was an obsessive insistence on sameness. I mean, it's pretty intense language, and that sort of translates into the tendency of a genuinely autistic child to want things to remain the same. routines, rituals, not purposeful, what's called stereotypical behavior, okay? Very tight criteria. Well, the goalposts have been moved drastically with the DSM-4 and in particular the DSM-5. Those criteria in the DSM-5 now speak of a range of social communication problems, from mild to moderate to severe, mm-hmm. which means two children that have some kind of a problem relating and communicating to people, to events in the outside world with completely different profiles are going to come up with this spectrum right. diagnosis. And when you've got an elastic diagnosis, you know what, Shelley? You no longer have a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
You no longer have a diagnosis. So I found that the children had most of them had other developmental issues. And by interacting them through play, I could put the diagnosis aside, say, forget about that. This child is not, I use the term genuinely autistic. Not everybody likes that, but that's okay. Genuinely autistic, according to Kanner's very tight criteria. And some children, very few children presented in that way. And many children presented with all kinds of other difficulties. But once you can stretch your diagnostic criteria, you're home free. You know, everybody's autistic. And that's
right.
You know, and now the numbers are soaring. And I'm certainly not the only voice that's saying, hey, folks, we better take a look at what these elastic diagnosis of a spectrum, autistic spectrum disorder, is doing. We're getting all these kids that have other issues.
And that's, I think, a very excellent point, and one that honestly I had not known of before speaking with you with the Relatable Voice. And, you know, when I first was coming into special education and learning about it, there were, I think the ratio was one in several hundred children, and I don't remember the exact number, would be somebody who was diagnosed with autism. And as you just mentioned, now we're down to, depending on the number, you know, who you're getting your point from, it's like one in 29.
Well, yeah, I think from week to week, you can look on the internet. I remember looking and it was 41 and 43. And then a few weeks later, or a couple months later, it was one in 30 something. And now you say one in 29. I think it's so important to realize what these elastic diagnostic criteria, the damage that it is doing, I think, to helping children who have a whole range of developmental difficulties. Some of them were completely normal. If it's of interest to you, I'd be happy to share some of the kinds of things that I was finding that were buried, covered up, masked, obscured by this one-size-fits-all autism diagnosis.
Yes, please. I was actually about to ask you to do that, so that was perfect.
Well, okay. I just happened to have...
And this is why, folks, we said we needed to work more together, because there's so much that we can almost... We're not reading each other's minds, of course, but there's just so much that leads so beautifully into conversations between us that we just wanted to share more with my audience and anyone who will pay attention to it. So
You got it. No, absolutely, Shelley. It's just so important. So the kinds of things that I was finding that were commonly misdiagnosed as autism spectrum disorder, some of them to me were just heartbreaking. Children with moderate to profound hearing impairments. Some of those were known. Some of those, if you can believe it, had not been diagnosed. Okay? Mm-hmm. So a child I think it's pretty clear. These are kind of things that lead to autistic-like symptoms, but it's not autism. Something, now this is kind of a fancy word, term, oral dyspraxia. In other words, the praxis, the muscles around the mouth and the brain are not hardwired. It's a little bit like, Shelley, if someone asked me to wiggle my ears, and I really want to do that, it would be so cool, you know, be the life of the party. I could wiggle my ears, it'd be so great. Come on, ears, do it. I can't do it because I don't have that gene. My ears are not hardwired. Similarly, I would see children who were, I could determine through the interaction with them, they're very present. They were very communicative, but they could not speak. They could not speak. There is treatment for it. I would refer them to someone else. That's one. Children from mild to moderate to very severe emotional problems that prevent them from communicating and relating. Children with kind of what I called a garden variety or miscellaneous developmental problems. See, you're talking to a psychologist that doesn't think that every condition that a child has to have a label in order for us to understand it and in order for us to work effectively. So miscellaneous developmental difficulties. Here's one that would break my heart. Typical children. I could see this child just with developmental delays. I could see the child just needed another year in kindergarten, another year in preschool, 2 years in first grade, and they were going to be fine.
Right.
Because conventional testing put them lower, and because ASD has become a one-size-fits-all diagnosis, they were in there. Occasionally there were children with selective mutism, that was rare. There were children with brain abnormalities and genetic syndromes. Now, obviously, I wasn't making that diagnosis. Those diagnoses were done by, you know, geneticist or a pediatric neurologist. But a lot of times, those difficulties had been ascertained and were in the referral material from such and such a hospital. This chamber of the brain is enlarged. Certain chromosomal deletion or something like that. And then because that impacted on the child's ability to communicate, also the code for ASD, autism. Wait a second. We know something else is going on with the child, and of course that's going to impact. So I think we're also allowed to use our intuition, our good common sense, our clinical skills. But wow, these days, you know, if you say 1 in 29, you know, I mean, I used to tell parents, look, mom and dad, and I'd show them the DSM, and I'd say, have a look at that. Because they'd come in tears. My child just got from such and such a specialist at such and such a hospital. And I said, well, let's have a look at that. And I said, have you had a look at what it says? Oh, a range. I said, look at what that is. That doesn't tell us anything about your child and his or her potential.
Yeah. And I used to, when I did teach full time, I knew eventually what each of my students' eligibility for special education services was. Mm-hmm. But I honestly just tried to get to know the student and find what worked for the particular student. The problem with that is that you have, well, here in the United States, we have legislators and book companies and whomever else. And I understand the reason behind it, but you have these people saying, well, you need to do X, Y, and Z for the student that is eligible for special education under this category. And you need to do A, B, and C for the one who is under this category. And, you know, you need to have the research based and the scientifically proven. And I understand that because you want things that have been proven, but at the same time, just because it was proven for a group of people, just because it's got science behind it, doesn't mean it is still going to work for every student. And we get stuck here in the United States when we write our IEPs, individualized education programs. There are questions on it that actually say, has there been a lack of education in English? Has there been a lack of education in math? And as long as the teachers and the people who are filling this out continue to say, no, there's not been a lack because they've had the research-proven curriculum and they're using a research-proven curriculum, we're doing, in my opinion, a disservice because we think we're off the hook. Well, I'm using this curriculum and this curriculum is designed for someone on the autism spectrum or someone with a specific learning disability or someone with Down syndrome. But no two people on the planet are exactly the same. And no two people on the planet, whether they're twins or triplets or an only child or they just have siblings, whatever, they're still not the same. And to stick us in that hole that we can't get out of unless you have people who are willing to think outside the box and put their jobs on the line, honestly, in a lot of situations. And Fran says that's the key, getting to know the student.
Student, right. What can I say? I so agree. For me, what I used was play. Now, my background as a psychologist is play therapy. Mm-hmm. But I think I had been at the Feuerstein Institute for just a couple of months, and I walked into the professor's office, and he said, I'd like you to meet Dr. Serena Weider. Now, your listeners may not know. I did not. I'm ashamed to say I did not know who she is, and I'll tell you the kind of revolution that she and her very notable colleague made in the field. She's a clinical psychologist, and along with the late child psychiatrist Dr. Stanley Greenspan, they developed a program. I hate to call it a program. It's not really a program. A method of developmental play, starting where the child is, called DIR floor time. If some of your listeners have never heard of it, it was just wonderful. It was a short hop from play therapy to DIR floor time. But the D stands for developmental, because you're going to start right where each autistic appearing child is. It's individual. You were just talking about the need, and Fran just wrote something about get to know each individual student. In this case, it was get to know each individual child. How? The child's not talking. How you can get to know them? Mm-hmm. A lot of times it's through the sensory, through touch, through movement, through rocking, through tickling, through spinning, through singing, and so on. And relationship, D-I-R, the R is relationship. It's always geared for creating through play activities a sense of what they call circles of communication. Energies going back and forth between you and the child who may be or appears autistic. And it's phenomenal. There's a whole what they call developmental ladder. I won't go into the whole thing. Did you just, what is DIR? Oh, good for you. Oh, right, there you go. Developmental individual differences and relationship-based model. It is brilliant. It is a phenomenal, phenomenal contribution to the field. Well, way back in 1992 or 93 maybe, when Serena was sitting in Professor Feuerstein's office, I did not know about DIR or about her, but that changed overnight, and the exposure and the learning of DIR. And then I didn't use the DSM to assess. I used DIR play strategies to get to know the individual child. And that became the model that I would demonstrate for the parents. Now, so I'm working at this Feuerstein Institute, which thankfully was a private institute. I want you to know, might be of interest to your listeners, this is incredible, that for many years, the institute did not charge a dime for what we were doing.
That's incredible.
You can imagine how much we were taking home, but that's a different story. It was a labor of love all around. But,
right.
You know, and that's because the professor was just committed to helping people, children and adults. And then in the last few years that I was there, you know, the realization came with the reality that I'm going to have to charge. But he ironclad said, no way are we going to charge no one will be denied services by what we could do. Anyway, email back at the ranch. So then I used the DIR strategies, which once I was introduced to them and started taking some of the courses and went to some of their conferences on the East Coast, and started to feel like I knew what I was doing with that, I used the DIR to assess the child to find out what's going on underneath the diagnosis, or as I called the title of my book, the second part of the title is The Child Behind the Symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy, relatively easy to see the symptoms a child has. You know that as an educator. This child cannot read. Okay, we can call it dyslexic if we want. And then what?
Let's go.
Yeah. And then, you know, like, okay, let's get down to business and help this kid. Let's find out. Let's take it apart. Let's figure out why the kid's not reading. And let's do it. Like, let's just roll up our sleeves and do it. And that was the attitude at the institute. Child not talking, child not looking, child not communicating, child not in touch with. Okay, yeah, okay, I see that. I can see that in about 15 minutes in the office. What, that's my job? No way. That's nothing. That's nothing. That's not the end of the road. That's the beginning. And I would say, with all due respect, I would say to the parents, I would say, you know, I would see so much beauty in each child and so much potential. Sometimes I'd have to reassure the parents. I'd say, don't worry, mom and dad. I see where your child is stuck. I do see why Dr. So-and-so at such and such a clinic said that your child has an autism. I see what tricked the doctor, so to speak, mm-hmm. what caught his attention. But I also see what the doctor didn't see. And Feuerstein called it islets of normalcy. We were looking for strengths with the children. Now, some people these days are like, oh, no, don't talk about normal. I'm okay with the word normal. You know, most kids walk around the age of a year. That's kind of normal. But I'm not going to think badly of a child who walks at 10 months or 11 months or 17 months or 24 months. I mean, there's nothing judgmental in that. Just saying, here, usually it happens around here. So right. I'm okay with that. But some people, I have a colleague who says examples of competency, if people are more comfortable with that. Call it what you will. We were looking, Shelley, actually it was kind of cute. Professor Feuerstein more than once he said to me, he said, Shoshana, he says, you take these children by the tips of their ears and you pull them up. You know, like get the little pincers out there, you know, and you sort of up you got. There you go. And when I say we were really looking for tiny, tiny, tiny examples in some of these developmentally challenged children, whether they're autistic or not. And it's not just Shoshana. I mean, I was working with a whole bunch of really talented colleagues there. I mean, super. We weren't there for the pay, I'll tell you that. We're not there for the pay.
As are most educators, not in it for the pay.
No, that's right. You're in it because you care.
Right.
That's really what it's about. So, for example, you take a child who wasn't looking, what would an eye in the whole sea of the child's symptomatic presentation, which most other professionals were seeing and labeling and itemizing on the DSM and symptom checklists and all that. I say, okay, I saw that. Can we put that aside now? I'd like to see where the hope is. I'd like to see where I can get my little pincettes out, you know, pincette things right. up and pull the child up. And it could be really weensy teensy, Shelley. It could be the fact that a child who has very poor eye contact suddenly made eye contact. It could be a child who had no language suddenly started vocalizing. That's enough. That's good. That's great. So find the islets of normalcy. And then the DIR model has a beautiful term called circles of communication. I referred to it before. Mm-hmm. So you take, from that perspective, you take everything the child does and you create a kind of a sense of a conversation. So child all of a sudden might start going, so what would I do?
Repeat it.
You bet. And if the child would tolerate a bit of physical closeness, I might sit them on my lap on the floor or on my lap in the chair in front of a mirror. Mm-hmm. And then we might be looking at each other, so we've got a little bit more contact while we're going, And then maybe a little bit of movement in that. And is the child following? So from those little weensy islets, sometimes they're not so weensy.
Right.
If you want, at some point in this our discussion, I can talk about some real kids.
We have about 20 minutes left already. Mm. So we've wow. already talked quite a bit. And when we did our RV too, I think we talked longer than the average one had gone because we just had so much to talk about. Before we get too close to the end, I do want you to share some of the tips that you have for parents so that we make sure that gets in here today because that's so important.
Oh, with you 100%. That is so important. There's an appendix in the book I summarize about 11 of the key points, but I'll just mention two or three here. I think one of the things that's most important, Shelley, because there's so much pessimism out there in the field of autism in terms of potential. And once you have it, you always have it. And I worked completely outside that kind of a way of thinking. So what's the operative recommendation here? Parents in particular, find professionals who see your child's potential. Find professionals to work with your child who believe that your child can move forward. It could be move forward a lot. Who are not putting an artificial glass ceiling. So many parents that I encountered had been assessed in other places and been told foolish things. Mm-hmm. Your child will never talk. Well, some children may never talk, but a lot of them can be brought to speech. Your child will never have friends. Your child will never learn. Your child, all kinds of nevers. Those people, I would advise parents, keep searching. Keep searching till you find someone who sees those sparks, those islets of normalcy in your child, or at least the potential the child has. So that's a critical one. A corollary to that, the second thing, in terms of finding safe professionals to work with your child, who will also nourish you as a parent and guide you along the way and not tell you your child will never, never, never. I is I think that the DIR practitioners are generally they're mental health or social work or educational professionals who've had to take a certain various levels of certification mm-hmm. through a couple of DIR organization. The ICDL website, International Council for Development and Learning, has a directory worldwide. You just type in, you go into the ICDL directory, professional directory, you type in, I live in Afghanistan, and if there's a DIR, I'm impressed. Wow. So fluid with this stuff, with this technology. that is amazing. And I would recommend that I do not have an expert level. I have the basic level, but someone I gave a webinar for said, well, Shoshana, you sure got your money's worth with your basic course. Which is so it's going to sound like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, but I would recommend that parents go for people with advanced or expert levels of training just to be on the safe side. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, I think I'm a safe practitioner, and I know that my colleagues and I have helped a lot of children. And the other thing, and this would be a whole interview in itself, so I won't rattle on about it, but I'll just give the headline here, and that is talk to your child. Talk to your child. So many parents are told, don't bother, at least the parents we encountered.
Wow.
Don't bother, your child doesn't understand language, he's not interested. I'm not saying all professionals give out those kinds of messages, but I was there for 25 years, I encountered so many parents from all over the world because they came to us from children with special needs from all over the world, not just within Israel, all over the world, and I do mean all kinds of countries. Fascinating and fabulous. So talk to your child, just to try to do 2 minutes about that. For many parents who have a child diagnosed with autism, talk to your child is something like, what's this? Watch. Say watch. What's this? Pencil. Say pencil, mm-hmm. etc. Okay. Professor Feuerstein and his speech therapy staff, we took a different, I'm not speech therapist, but I work closely with speech therapists. We took a completely different tack, and we talk about here's how I put it to parents, be the voiceover in the documentary of your child's life.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's a great way to place it, I think.
So can I give an example? So for example, you're giving your child oatmeal in the morning, okay? And it's a cold winter morning, hopefully with some snow, because we need all
this. Right.
And your child has a diagnosis of autism, and you're thinking, well, he looks kind of like he's in his own world right now, and he's flapping his hands, or he's just flipping through his book, and talk to him. Don't interrogate him. Don't ask him to name everything on the table. Just like you talk to your other kids. Sweetie, listen, I'm going to give you just half a bowl this morning because the school bus is going to be here early. Put it down. It's really, really hot. I'm going to blow on it for you. You know what? I'm going to give you some raisins. In other words, you're just talking about what you're doing. Now I'll help you with your coat. Let's get that right arm in. Let's get that. Oh, it's cold out there. Let's put your scarf around your neck 3 times. Many parents will say, that's too much. You know, they told me to speak in 2-3-word sentences. And we went the other way and we just said, you can shorten it, lengthen it according to what you feel your child is taking in. But if you do that, there are changes. Now, that what I've just said, Shelley, is the beginning of something really important. Unfortunately, parents need guidance of what to do with that.
Right.
Because usually what happens when you do that consistently, you're just kind of talking to what I call the child behind the symptoms. You get more eye contact and you think, wow, he does seem a little more relaxed or something. You start to feel a shift in the child. And that can be taken further, but it is so important to talk to your child. It's also good for mommy and daddy. It's so discouraging to think you're sitting with a child who's not there, but they are.
Right. They're there. I take what you just said, and I do that with children, but I think I get the desire to do it from stories of people who have been in the hospital in a coma or, you know, something for long periods of time.
Yeah.
And when they are able to wake up, or the stories of those people that have not spoken for, you know, a decade or two decades, and suddenly they are able to communicate and they can speak thousands of words, or they can type thousands of words. And I always remind myself that we don't know. So assume the best. Mm-hmm. Because I feel, and it's just my opinion, but if we don't set that limit of here, we can go higher. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk to people when they're, you know, not speaking to us, don't assume that they can't understand just because they're not responding in a way that we're expecting them to respond.
Mm-hmm. Very,
you know,
true.
Exactly what you just are along the lines of what you just said, where, you know, maybe they don't seem so stressed. They've just communicated. We expect that communication is only verbal, and it's not. In fact, what is the percentage? It's like 7% or something out of, you know, communication is actually the words that we speak. And the other 93%, and again, it'll depend on, you know, where you get your points of information from. But I know it's a very minute part of communication is the actual words. But then the rest of it is body language, tone of voice, you know, where it's said, how it's said. And so how someone is communicating does not only have to be with words. And I think we have to get a better understanding and a better grasp of that. And then I think that will help people, parents especially, understand that their child is communicating to them. It's just not necessarily with words. And I have a couple of stories like that in my book, wherever it is. where
behind your left shoulder, Shelley.
Yeah, exactly. Where I had, you know, families that I interviewed for the book that their children didn't communicate with words, but they absolutely had conversations with their child. And to those of us that weren't in tune to the child as much, we weren't 100% sure that that was a real conversation going on. But when I spent enough time with these families, with this mom and this son, or this mom and her daughter that had these conversations, it was a conversation. It was a two-way conversation. And it's beautiful. And it's absolutely communication. And we just, sorry, I went off on my own little.
You know, when you've lived something and you've changed lives and so on in a way of, it becomes part of us, and we just need to talk. You and I need to talk about it. You know what I mean? Share it and say there's a different way. We don't autism. I know many people. There are many people, older adults and so on, who are taking this autism diagnosis, and they feel it helps them with their identity. Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I would never say to someone, "You can't do that."
Sure.
But if I'm working with a young child, and I, whether I'm a teacher, a psychologist, a social worker, a speech therapist, whatever, and I see there's incredible potential in there, I'm not going to stop with the child's initial presentation. I'm going to help them see I'm going to help them realize that You know, it just in this in the same way. If well, yeah, that I think that's all I want to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and Fran agrees with us. Fran happens to be the mom of two children who are now adults that have disabilities. And so she absolutely
She knows it from the inside out.
Yeah, and absolutely, you know, she said too, seeing the potential. And what I have put into the chat boxes, hopefully it's appearing on Facebook and on YouTube today. I know Facebook was having some difficulties earlier, is Dr. Shoshana's website, the DIR Floor Time website. And also I put the DIR Floor Time, or no, I'm sorry. I put the
Feuerstein
Institute's Facebook link in there as well. Okay. So all of that information is available.
Amazon, people could.
Oh, yeah. And Amazon for your book. And we're not done yet. I just wanted to put those things out there. We have about 8 minutes that we can get in as much as we can in those 8 minutes. And then we do have to say goodbye, which will be very sad because I really do think you and I could talk for days. And still, I just think we are so much on the same belief track.
Very much. Yeah.
You know,
which is sorely needed in the fields of education and psychology. There is, again, I started out saying, you know, there's so much jargon today, and you have to be picky about it. Does this really enhance my vision of what I'm doing, or does it cloud my vision? And if the jargon clouds, then toss it out and trust your gut.
Yeah. So what sort of things do you think we need to do to move forward?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a tough question.
And one I didn't prep you for.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. Hey, I said I was open to like free stuff. Right? I think in the universities, in particular in training professionals, two things. First, I'll start off first with parents, because in my work, I didn't just work with the children. It also required a lot of encouraging parents and so on. And I think it's important for parents to understand the weakness of this diagnosis. I really think it will help them trust themselves. You know, I'll never forget one parent. So that's one thing. One parent. There weren't that many. Most parents came in just crushed. I was in this world famous center with a world famous expert. And here's what they said about my child, and it's absolutely autism. And I would say, he's got some what's called autistiform features, but it's not really. And I do remember one parent, it was very interesting. I'm sure there were more. Where I didn't have to persuade her, she said, you know, I got on the internet and I saw all the criteria and we went to such and such a clinic. And, but you know what? I don't think my child is autistic. He's got a great sense of humor and he really loves cuddles and he's so much fun to be with. And he had a bad day there when they assessed him, you know? And I said, great. Trust that. So, the corollary to what I was saying is parents, trust yourself and your knowledge of your kid. And sometimes it's very confusing and very stressful if a child has a problem. So that's one thing. I think for practitioners, it's just as important to understand that this is not the right metaphor, but or the right adage to go with it, but we're not playing with full deck. The conventional psychology is not playing with a full deck when it comes to these diagnoses, and that we're actually using them to obscure the child's weaknesses and strengths, and that we need to get not only to get to know each individual, but to trust our own instincts as clinicians. I don't think that being an effective clinician is simply a job of pegging a kid and putting him in a box with a label. I think it requires much more intuition, common sense, vision about human beings, understanding of the possibility of human change, I think it requires much more than ticking off boxes. So I think that's how I would love to, see, for example, in university courses, one of my projects, which I keep putting off, interestingly, is to do a PR thing through the universities, because my book questions a lot of the sacred cows of psychology in the field of autism. And I think psychologists in training and other practitioners in training need to be questioning the tools that they're learning.
Yep.
What are the limitations? And where does all of this end and the child begin? I better know how to do that.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And trying to get my book into universities, because a lot of what my book talks about is from the parent's perspective and the child who's going through special education's perspective.
Critical.
And, you know, and I've done a few book studies with some teacher groups, and they've all said it's changed them, and they have so appreciated the book because it gives them a different perspective that they either hadn't thought about or had forgotten about. And so, you know, I absolutely think, based on what you're telling me about your book, that it would absolutely be the same way, because we do. We tend to get into a rut of, you know, and again, this goes back to the legislators and that, you know, we have the wonderful special education law here in the United States. And, you know, it's helped hundreds of thousands of children get an education as they deserved. But what it's also done is I now hear parents say things like, well, my doctor doesn't really think that it's autism, but in order for my child to get help in school, they'll give them the autism diagnosis to push along the eligibility process.
Well, I encountered that in Israel as well. Absolutely. You may not agree with me. I did not oppose that. In other words, if a parent said to, I would say to a parent, you know, I've seen your child now 4 times, 2-hour session each time, playing, interacting, working at the table, whatever they could do. I've come to the conclusion it's not autism. And the parent already was getting money from the national insurance system here to, you know, monthly stipend help. And I would say to them, to the parent, I thought that was okay. I'd say, listen, it's a misdiagnosis. It is an incorrect diagnosis. Your child has this. This is what we need to do to help your child. I said, but don't worry. I'm not going to pick up the phone to the national insurance and say, do you know that little Joey isn't really autistic? You should keep that money in your coffers and not. No, because little Joey still needs speech therapy. He still needs occupational therapy. He still needs an integration aid, even though he's not autistic.
Right.
It's a shame that they have to have that label. But I say to the parent, don't let the label define your child.
Yeah.
Don't let the label define your child. He's still your, he, she is still your child that you know and love. And this, let's just assume and work toward the sky's the limit and see how far he can take it.
Right.
But don't let the don't let that diagnosis kind of limit your relationship and also limit your vision of your child. So right. I didn't have any problem with parents. I never gave it out. I mean, I could write it. First of all, I'm not a government agency, but I wasn't working for a government agency, but I would, you know, if I thought the child was genuinely autistic, I would say why, but I'd say, here's what we need to do to help the child. And if I thought it was a misdiagnosis, I'd say, no, I disagree with this diagnosis for the following reason. Child has a great sense of humor. He takes tons of initiative, et cetera, et cetera. So
don't let
it define the child. That's the thing.
Right. And my point was kind of going along the same lines of the, you know, your child is getting help. The law says they have to be eligible under, you know, one of 14 categories. Autism is one of those categories, even though the doctors, as I said, they don't necessarily think it's autism, but they're going to label someone as autism so that they could possibly, it's not a guarantee, get the services in the school system. And I was like you, that was kind of the other reason I didn't really pay much attention to the eligibility that my students had, because
it didn't matter
to me. You know, they were a student first. They were a human being first.
I'm sure you would agree. What's important is to get to the parents and say, like, if the diagnosis is true, it's true. So you say, yes, it's true. But here's what we can do to help your child. But if it's not, you say, okay, you have to use it. That's the political reality these days.
Yep.
But hey, believe in your child.
Absolutely. That's absolutely. And that's a perfect spot to end. Believe in your child and believe your mama and daddy gut. You know, if you don't believe that your child has whatever it is that they're being diagnosed with, or that they have something that they're not being diagnosed with, keep following that. Follow it up. Ask other professionals. Dr. Fox, it's been so awesome to have you with me today. I so appreciate your time. And yes, absolutely. We could spend 5 more episodes at least, I think, talking about all the different things that we have in the same belief path. And maybe I will have you back on another time, because I have very much enjoyed this, and you have so much knowledge and wisdom, and I thank you for sharing it with my audience today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Shelley.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next week.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelley Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykino.com, SHELLEYKENOW.